This is the Grafted In Perspective.
Let my people go!
Now when Israel was in Egypt land,
let my people go!
Oppressed so hard they could not stand,
let my people go.
So the Lord said, go down,
go down,
Moses,
Moses,
way down,
down
in Egypt land. Tell old Pharaohs to let my people go.
Let my people go.
Hello and welcome back to the Grafted In Perspective. We are a podcast that's dedicated to exploring what it means to be grafted into the Commonwealth of Israel through our Messiah, Yeshua. You are listening to the fourth installment of the Grafted In Perspective. And with me tonight is Darren Huckey from a ministry called Emet HaTorah.
Hey, how's it going? It's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining me tonight. And glad we overcame our technical difficulties again tonight. And you had some spotty internet availability, so, and you're coming, it's a coincidence that you're coming from Arkansas, right? So, now we were making jokes the internet is kind of spotty up in Arkansas, but no, you are based out of Arkansas, is that correct?
That is correct. And I'd forgotten this is, the first Monday of the month, which, you know, we usually have internet for like 2 hours a day and I had to sort of work around it. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same as in Costa Rica, if I'm not mistaken. I guess it's on the same.
there you go.
But no, you are with Emet HaTorah, and I think you recently became the director of that ministry. Is that right?
This is true. And if you don't mind, I'll just jump into that, and we can backtrack if you want. But that sort of happened. This ministry has been around for about 10 years, and it started with a good friend of ours who is a Messianic rabbi from the Dallas area. And he was with an existing national ministry at the time about 10 years ago and just felt really inhibited to share really the fullness of Torah with people. And through that ministry, it was a Messianic ministry, but yet it wasn't Torah-focused, Torah-centered, you know, one of these ministries which sort of use the Jewish stuff as sort of a marketing tool. More than a lifestyle. And he got a little frustrated with that and decided to launch out on his own. And I helped him get this started about 10 years ago. And just recently, this past March, he left to pursue other endeavors, focusing on Israel advocacy and doing a lot more tours and things of that nature, and handed over the teaching ministry to me. And so I've been refocusing it, taking sort of my perspective as the direction for the ministry and leading it that way.
Excellent. So Darren, first of all, tell me about yourself, your testimony. You know, what is your story? How did you become a follower of Messiah? And then I guess what aspects have changed the most about your life as a result of that decision to follow our Messiah?
Sure. You know, I grew up in church. My parents were Sunday school teachers. My father was a deacon. We grew up in a Assembly of God church. And, you know, I grew up loving the Lord as a mainstream Christian. But I was always one that was searching. I wanted to know the truth, even if it hurt me. And a lot of my friends couldn't understand that. And you know, would cringe, you know, when I would ask questions. And so back in 1998, my wife and I were married in 1994. And after being married 4 years in 1998, a lot of things changed in our lives. The first thing that changed was that I quit my job and began working for myself as a graphic designer and a web developer. And and then through that, I had a lot of time and no clients in which to explore, pursue, study, that kind of thing. Well, you know, I didn't really have an agenda towards study or anything at that point because I wasn't really interested, even though at the time I was the youth pastor and worship leader for a non-denominational church here in my town. And I just was sort of, you know, had put things on cruise and going along. And then my wife found out about something called the Jerusalem Conference. And it was a conference put on near us that had Dr. Ron Mosley, who actually led the Jerusalem Conference, and he still does it to a limited degree today. But at that conference, there was Dr. Ron Mosley, there was Dwight Pryor, Brad Young, and Marvin Wilson all together. And I'd never heard of any of these guys at that point. And so somehow she talked me into going. I wasn't real keen on the idea, but we ended up going. And as I sat back and listened to these guys, I was just totally blown away because, you know, in Sunday school and youth group and everything, I was sort of the answer kid. You know, it's like when everybody doesn't know the answer, call on Darren and he'll give you the answer. And you know, it's just one of those automatic answer things where, you know, pat answers were pretty much my life. I did explore, like I said, I did ask questions in other areas, but never seemingly related to my faith. And this began that exploration time of asking questions because these guys were talking about things that were just totally over my head and totally did not make sense to me. And I didn't know what to do with it at that point. And these guys are, you know, for the most part, they're not really messianic. They're more Hebraic roots, just looking at the Jewish roots of Christianity and things like that. And so with that, I began to have to rethink a lot of my biblical history, knowledge, theological positions, and so forth. And like I said, at that time, I had a lot of time on my hands, so I just began to study. By study, I mean like 6 hours plus a day, just digging in and researching, studying, reading books, you know, purchasing books to read, starting building a library, reading lots of stuff on the internet. Had a daily email that I would send out of the things I was learning. So, and that, you know, just perpetuated into a more of a self-learning aspect of my life. And so I just continued to just pursue truth and knowledge. And then a few years down the road, we came into contact with some actual messianic believers. And, you know, that was sort of the next level. They sort of challenged me in a lot of areas as well. And just this whole concept of what the Torah means and us as, you know, 20th century believers and you know, all that kind of stuff. And it just sort of blew me out of the water. I started reevaluating a lot of that stuff. And it hooked us up with, like I said, many other messianic believers, and we developed a home fellowship out of that, and that sort of lasted for about the last 10 years. And often we would have pretty regular meetings. We would spend all day, sometimes into the night, into the next day, you know, studying together, asking questions, searching out scriptures. Lots of times, you know, families would stay over to one another's house and be exploring stuff, and just a really neat, unique relationship that, you know, I've never had in the church per se. And it really solidified the idea of community as well as a deep search for truth and how to explore that and then live it out.
Yeah, that's neat. I also have a background in the Assemblies of God denomination. And I've met several people who have, I guess, come to the more Hebraic understanding of their faith that are from the Assembly of God denomination. And it just kind of fell in my lap probably a month or so ago. I was handed, I think it's the new 95 theses that someone, it might have been, oh man, I hope I'm getting this right, Daniel Juster put this out through the Assemblies of God on why Israel has a prophetic relationship still. It basically made the Assemblies of God denomination, the first Christian denomination, to, I guess, unofficially denounce replacement theology in a way.
Wow.
Which is
nice.
Really interesting. Yeah, I'd have to find that pamphlet again. My dad is actually an Assemblies of God pastor, and he's the one that provided it to me. And that's one of the first things I pointed out to him was, this makes the Assemblies of God the first denomination to do that. And I wonder, I can only speculate that because there's so many people that I've cross paths with in this movement that are from the Assemblies of God, I wonder if that as a result of the affirmation of the plan that God has still for Israel and has in store for Israel. But
right. Right. I know I grew up, we had, good, at least speech and thoughts towards Israel. There was not a whole lot of, support in other ways.
Right.
But yeah, there wasn't anti-Semitism in outward, things. There wasn't, any animosity, but there was, people talking about tours and going to Israel and all that kind of stuff. And so, a lot of good things there.
Right. Right. Yeah. I can remember having on our church platform, the American flag and the Israeli flag. And that kind of was always something that stuck out in my head. I remember vividly to this day as even a young child looking at the Israeli flag and asking my parents, what is that? And there was always something that was, held in high esteem, I guess, were the people of Israel and their prophetic plan, I guess, yet to be fulfilled. Darren, what is your passion? I know you focus a lot on the concept of discipleship.
Right.
And I actually found you originally through a blog that you maintain called Digging with Darren. And in that, you focused a lot on discipleship, what discipleship looks like, going back to the Great Commission to go out into the nations and make disciples and teaching them everything that he obeyed. I guess in a world that is living in and guided by the idea of self-sovereignty and people serving themselves and filling their pockets in a sense of power in it of themselves, what do you find the most challenging aspect of being a student of a first century Jewish rabbi?
Well, that's an interesting question. With all that sort of combined, I think that one of the biggest challenges is, especially with the people I come in contact with and being in the South and in the West, is that we want things that are, first of all, instant. We want things that are easy. And when, faith is involved, we want easy, instant faith. And this is the big thing that I've struggled with within Christianity that I'm trying to make changes in. And I'm trying to do this now, not from the outside, but from the inside. And what I mean by that is that, we had separated ourselves from the church proper many years ago, and just only 3 years ago reintegrated back into the church. Because, if we're not part of the solution, we're only pointing our finger at the problem. Hmm. And so, we integrated back in so that we could be a voice within the church to address problems such as this. And the biggest problem with what I just said in mind is that we have gotten this whole concept of salvation down to a science. It's almost an art. Have this formula that we go through, this ritual that we go through. Boom, we have salvation. Now let's get on with our lives. There's attempts at bringing people under the kingship of Yeshua, but those efforts seem a little stifled because people really don't know what they're trying to do. Because what happens is we have been beaten down so much by this whole mentality of we can't earn our salvation, and it's not works-based and all that kind of stuff, that anything that we do, now we have to justify of, I'm not trying to earn my salvation here. I'm just trying to obey this one little thing. And obedience takes a back seat to what I would call greasy grace. Hmm. And there's a quote that Dallas Willard has said that I really appreciate. He says that in today's society, he said, we're not only just saved by grace, but we're paralyzed by grace. Mm. And I think that's an issue that I really am trying to address within the church, of saying that, yes, you know, it is grace through faith that we are saved, but that doesn't negate our responsibility. And our responsibility is to step up to the plate and be the disciples that Yeshua has called us to be and live out the way that he has spoken to us and called us to live. And, you know, when we are making excuses of why we can't do such and such or we shouldn't do such and such, and there are things that are black and white that he's told us to do, they're in the scriptures, then, you know, we need to reevaluate, step back and say, you know, is this really the way that, that our faith should be? And that's what I want to do. I want to cause us to reevaluate our faith and the way we do things and create a spark. That's all I'm doing. I know that we cannot, as an organization in Emet HaTorah, we cannot make disciples, okay? Because an organization doesn't make disciples, no matter what anybody tells you. People make disciples. So our job is not to make disciples. Our job is to create the spark within people to first become disciples so that they can in turn make disciples.
Now, what are the overall goals of Emet HaTorah? I mean, what is the goals of the ministry? Where do you see the ministry, you know, 5 years from now?
We have several things that we're trying to accomplish. As you can tell by the things that we're writing, we're producing, that we are recording and teaching, it's all focused around discipleship for one. And within that, there are different aspects that we're focused on. And some of those things are looking at restoring the gospel. What is the gospel? Because we have become so far removed from the original gospel message and redefined the gospel that, you know, I think we've lost track of what the gospel is, and we need to redefine the gospel according to scripture. I think that's going to take a lot of work, but it's a task that is worth taking on. And because what that's going to do is it's going to change our perspective of simply going out and making converts into going out and making disciples. Because the gospel right now that we're is a very small component of the complete gospel found within the scriptures. We are only preaching and teaching the singular component of salvation, and there's much more involved in that, and particularly the kingship of Messiah and the restoration of Israel. And so with that, when we only preach and teach this one little aspect, and I'm not saying it's not important. It is important. Salvation is definitely important, but I think we have focused on it to the detriment of so many other things that it has led to where we are now, in that we are largely ineffective in our outreach efforts, in our discipling, and so forth. And so that's really our focus, is to keep everything discipleship focused, and then have everything that we do, everything that we teach, everything, every move that we make and words that we say, revolving around that central idea of discipleship. And here's the deal. We have a core belief that everything sort of revolves around. And that belief is that we believe that every believer has the potential to change the world. But more importantly, we believe that every disciple is equipped and has the ability to change the world. And so therefore, it's our commission, I guess you would say, to create that spark within individuals to encourage them to make that transformation from a believer to a disciple.
Yeah, it's very good. Now, you put out a monthly newsletter called the Talmudim Report. For those that don't know, that Talmudim is Hebrew for disciples. And you can sign up for this on www.emethatorah.com. It's EmethaTorah.com. And you're doing a series right now, Restoring the Gospel. So I kind of want to tie into this a little bit. And it just so happened I got my newsletter today, which is really cool timing. But in it, you say, a gospel focused entirely on salvation alone is an emasculated gospel, stripped of its effectiveness, limited in its scope and its power, and we are seeing the fruits of such. We have churches filled with people who have accepted the gospel of salvation, but never accepted the gospel of Jesus. He said, therefore, we have millions of fans of Jesus who have believed in a message concerning the justification of their sins, but how many disciples are there who are rejecting sin and working towards the restoration of the kingdom? And I just read this and I said, man, that's just so powerful because, and you said something similar in your online, your audio teaching that you have available called The Four Responsibilities of a Disciple. You said, there's a difference between evangelism and discipleship. A convert is one who has changed their label, but not necessarily their lifestyle. The way Yeshua talks about discipleship is completely unique to the rabbinic relationship with their disciples in the first century, and it is not duplicated in any other context, or it can't be duplicated in any other context, in any other culture or any other time period. What we need to do is not recreate time, but what we need to do is recreate the expectations of our master in this first century context. And I think that's really the meat and potatoes, if you will, of what does it mean? What does it look like to be a disciple of a teacher? We've totally, you know, and our enemy has thrown dirt, loads and loads of dirt in on our excavation site. Like you, going back to your blog of digging in with Darren, you know, we're trying to excavate what did it look like, the relationship of a student and a teacher. And we can really go back into the rabbinic writings and figure out a lot of, you know, the details and the minutia of that relationship. So I really appreciate that about your teaching style and your ministry too.
Well, thank you. I think it's real important because, you know, we've unfortunately 2,000 years removed in language and culture and so forth. We have redefined a lot of biblical terms in our terms, in our own wisdom and understanding. And I think it's time that we go back to the biblical model, the biblical definitions, and look at these more closely and examine these in ways that we haven't done previously, and then apply them to our lives. Just like you quoted there, we can't go back to the first century, and I'm not advocating that we try to, but we can take those principles that Jesus, that Yeshua, and the apostles would have been dependent upon in their living out their disciple-rabbi relationship and apply them to our context today. And, you know, we don't have necessarily people that we would call rabbi like we would call Yeshua rabbi, and we don't need to because he is our rabbi and he will always be our rabbi. But we should look to him in that capacity, and we should be as dedicated as his disciples were then. And we need to know what that means. We need to know what that looks like, what that smells like, what that tastes like, and every aspect about it so that we can become what he expects of us. You know, in the teaching I do on discipleship and the four responsibilities of a disciple, as you stated previously, there's not another relationship in culture or history that exactly models that of a rabbi-disciple relationship of the first century. With that, we have to realize that as the disciples came into this relationship with Yeshua, there were certain things that were expected of them. He never had to articulate that because they were just common knowledge. They were a given. In today's culture, we don't know those things anymore. They aren't common knowledge. They aren't a given. And so I'm trying to allow us to see these again for the first time in our modern context and put them in a modern context where we can actually live them out without thinking we have to wear a toga and sandals around the shores of the Galilee. Mm. And so we want to be able to take on those responsibilities as disciples and implement them into our modern lives without compromise, though.
That's very good. How do we become a disciple? What's step number one?
Okay. Let me just go over how I've laid it out. To me, in my research and studies and what I'm primarily writing about, there are four primary responsibilities that every disciple is responsible for. And the first thing that sort of starts the ball rolling, I guess would be the answer to your question, would be responsibility number one, and that would be devotion. We need to be 100% sold out to our rabbi. In other words, we need to be clinging to Yeshua like none other. We need to see him for who he is. We need to hang on his every word. We need to drink in his teachings with just thirst. We need to cling to him in a way that is that people will visibly see that our lives are different. I think that's huge. You know, there's a concept in Hasidic Judaism called Devekut, and it's a concept that, you know, since God is fire, basically, but the Torah tells us to cling to God, how do we do that without getting just burnt? And it's actually interesting that the concept is through an intermediary, and that is of one's rabbi. You cling to your rabbi who clings to Hashem, to God. And so with that, how much more so in our relationship to the Messiah of Israel, that we cling to him in a way that's so tight that we are bonded not only with him, but with the Father as well. There's a quote I would like to read to you here. It comes from the Talmud. If you want an easy way to reference it, it's in the book Every Man's Talmud by Abraham Cohen. But it says, the greatest dignity attached to the profession of teacher, I'm sorry, the greatest dignity was attached to the profession of teacher, and he was held in the highest esteem. In certain matters, Jewish law gives him precedence even over a parent, because the parent only brings the child to the life of this world, whereas the teacher brings him into the life of the world to come. And so, again, how much more so with Yeshua? And so, to me, that is the first step. And then from there, that sort of gives you the impetus and the reason to continue on with the following three steps. From there, it would be you would memorize your rabbi's words. We have an obligation to memorize, properly understand, and to transmit his teachings. We don't think of this a lot because we don't live in a largely oral culture as did Yeshua and his disciples. And so we think, you know, write it down, throw in a notebook, put it on Evernote, and we have it for later. And this is not the way we need to be doing it, because what if our phone loses its charge? Our computer, you know, crashes, internet's down, like I had issues with the last 2 days. What do we do then? And so what if our Bibles are taken away from us, God forbid, which one day I believe is going to happen in this country, unfortunately. Yeah. And so we need to have his words, who Peter says when people are forsaking Yeshua, and he turns to Peter and he says, so are you going to do the same, basically? And Peter says, well, where would we go? You hold the words of eternal life. And if we really believe that, then we need to put those words within us. And a good place to start, in my opinion, is the Sermon on the Mount. It's a large chunk of his teachings, and it's thematic in style. It goes from one theme to another quite easily, and it's just a good passage to begin learning his words. And so with that, we memorize his words, and then we begin to internalize them, and then we need to learn how to properly understand them and interpret them, and then we need to retransmit them to others.
Yeah, very good. You know, Sermon on the Mount is so important because it's really Yeshua's inaugural kind of soapbox moment right as he kicks off his ministry, and it kind of, I think, sets the tone for the rest of his ministry leading up to his, you know, atoning work for us on the cross. And I think, you know, just to reemphasize the importance of the Sermon on the Mount, because that is really the bedrock of his ministry. He's laying out the tenets of, you know, his I guess, essence and his ministry for the next, you know, some say 70 weeks, 3.5 years, whatever it is. His entire ministry is kind of, I guess, boiled down to that Sermon on the Mount. And I think that's really important that we do internalize that, like you said.
Exactly. And, you know, just as you said, he starts off his ministry with this, and he's giving the framework for his teachings as well when he frames it within the framework of Torah. And if we don't understand that, then we are going to do what the church has done for the last 2,000 years nearly, is we are going to just memorize the literal words, and we are going to misapply and misinterpret them. And I believe it's important for us as Messianics to be very careful in our understanding and our application and our interpretation and how we use this to correct and things like that, because we have an obligation to our master. And if we say we have, just as Yeshua spoke out to the Pharisees, if we say we are enlightened, then we especially need to be guarded against this hypocrisy and against pointing out other people's errors if we're not taking care of our own. And so we need to use the words of our master very, very carefully and use them on ourselves first. Hmm. With that, that's really – that one thing I just said is really what got me into this whole discipleship thing. Because, you know, learning all of this stuff, it's – what do I do? Well, the first thing that has to be done is I've got to deal with me. You know, there's a quote, Rabbi Salanter is quoted as saying that, you know, he wanted to change the world and he set off to do it. And then he realized he couldn't change the world. So he decided he was going to change his country. Once he realized he couldn't change his country, he decided he's going to change his city. He realized then he couldn't change his city. So he decided he's going to change his family. By that time, his family had, his children had grown up and moved off, and his wife had become old and so forth. And there was no way he was going to change his family. So he said, the only person I had left to change was myself. And that's where his path began. And he, of course, as you know, is one of the strongest voices within the Musar movement and of discipleship, of self-change and, you know, reflecting of who we are as opposed to what we're saying we should be doing. And he began a worldwide movement of change within Judaism because of that. And so that's really at the heart of what I would like to do with Emet HaTorah, is say, let's stop pointing our fingers so much on the outside and start looking in, and then we can change what's around us.
Now, in today's terms, you know, some of those listening to this right now, maybe attending a church or a congregation on a regular basis, you know, there's spiritual leaders there. There's those that are in leadership, whether it be a Sunday school teacher, a congregational rabbi or pastor, what have you. The idea of spiritual mentorship or spiritual authority is kind of a sticky subject. We as Americans living in Western culture, we don't like the idea of authority or I guess acknowledging someone's sovereignty over us in the capacity mm-hmm. of mentoring us on spiritual matters or biblical matters, how it is we are to live out our faith. How do we find a mentor or teacher? And do we even do that?
That is a really, it's a good question. It's a delicate question. You know, we've had so much abuse within Christianity that this subject of coming under a mentor, a discipler, some use the term shepherd, it for the most part makes a lot of people just cringe. You know, I haven't really broached that aspect of things yet. I mean, I've looked all my life for somebody who would take me under their wings, and I've not found it. Within the last 5 years or so, I've found other men that would come along beside me and would challenge me and would correct me and would encourage me. And so with that, that's not something I know a whole lot about at the moment, so I can't completely address it. But I will say that with us having such a problem with that in the West, you know, it speaks to our heart, and we need to address our heart. And our heart, the Bible says, is one that we cannot trust. And we have rebellion within our hearts that needs to be rooted out. And I'm not saying go and blindly trust somebody to rule every aspect of your life, but we need to find people in our lives that we can allow to speak into our lives and be able to trust and say, I need some correction if I'm going off base here. Mm-hmm. And that right there to me is an open door that's going to allow us to be, first of all, humble, and second, corrected before there's a problem instead of after it, and just walk, you know, a consistent walk before the Lord rather than fall on our faces in public, you know.
Now, how do we make and train disciples when we feel we are fully equipped? And with James chapter 3, verse 1, where he says, not many of you should become teachers, for you will be judged with greater strictness if you are. But is that commission, is that calling to be a trainer or a teacher, I guess, for everyone?
You know, I've been asked a similar question by many people. Relates back to the Great Commission. It says, you know, go ye therefore make disciples, in the King James, of course. And we ask ourselves, you know, well, is that really for me, or is it just for the apostles? Well, let's think about it this way. What is a disciple? If we get that definition right, then we can come up with an easy answer for this. And so the one thing I like to tell people to visualize is, what if there was an acorn that did not have the ability to produce oak trees? Would it truly be an acorn, or would it be something false? And so the responsibility, per se, of an acorn is to produce oak trees that produce acorns, which will in turn produce oak trees. Emerson once said that within an acorn lies 1,000 forests. And I think that's the same concept of a disciple, because a disciple doesn't have the ability to make disciples who in turn make disciples. It's not really a disciple, because that's the whole point of discipleship. It's to reproduce your rabbi. It's to become like your rabbi. And what does your rabbi do? He produces disciples. So when we become like our rabbi, we produce disciples. Now, we have a unique case in that we don't produce disciples for ourselves, but we produce disciples for our rabbi, Yeshua. Mm-hmm. And so with that concept, if a disciple is not producing disciple, is he really a disciple? Or is he what I would call a GMO Christian, a genetically modified Christian?
A hybrid.
And exactly.
They're sterile.
Exactly. Sterile. And we within the church have for too long accepted sterile disciples. And it's time that we change them.
When we take on the yoke of our teacher, Yeshua, does anything in our lives go untouched? It's a semi-rhetorical question, because, you know, anyone out there that is listening would say, well, absolutely not, absolutely not. But when we go into any congregation, any church, any body of believers that say we are followers of Jesus, you don't, I mean, all due respect, you don't see a zeal for the Word of God. You don't see a zeal for those things that a first century pious Jew would have zeal for. I'm talking to myself here too. When I went to church every Sunday, I went to church, I went to a restaurant, I went home and took a nap. And there right. was no zeal in me to really fulfill the call in my life to go and make a disciple, or to go and feed the needy, or to go and visit those that are imprisoned, or anything like that. So I guess I'm saying all that. What goes untouched when you become a disciple? Is there anything that goes unchanged about our lives?
Well, let me ask you a question. When you light a piece of paper with a match, is there any part of that paper that doesn't get consumed? You know, the fire is consuming. So with Yeshua and with his call to be his disciple, I would say that if we are not totally consumed, that we were never set on fire, or something has put us out and caused us to be just a smoldering ember. You know, I think part of the problem is, back to our earlier conversation about the gospel, is that within our churches, and this is an issue I'm trying to address very cautiously within the church, is that our sole focus has been on so much on salvation that we don't know how to disciple people. We don't know the first thing about discipling people, because all we know what to do is preach to people about how to get saved. And once they get saved, then it's, oh, I don't know what to do with these people. I've had multiple pastors and staff members from large churches come up to me and say, you know, I hear you're doing this message thing about discipleship. You know, we need that, because, you know, we have people come to salvation every week, but then we don't know what to do with them. we have our church full of new believers, but we don't know what to do with them. We don't know where to go from there. It's truly sad because we're sort of a one-trick pony. You know, if we can look at the gospel in terms of more than just salvation, then I believe this whole discipleship concept is going to start clicking in to people's minds and become part of who we are as a people. And it's going to encompass people's entire lives rather than one moment at the altar. And so that's my goal, is to try to change this mentality and help us to not only, you know, cross the world to make a convert, but cross the street, invest in the life of a person, a neighbor, and make a disciple.
Now, you've got some speaking engagements coming up. Is that correct?
That is correct. Be doing a little mini tour down in the southeast. I'll be hitting around the Jackson, Mississippi area. We will be in Pensacola, Florida. We will be in Birmingham, Alabama. We will be in the Atlanta, Georgia area, and then Macon, Georgia. Maybe a few other places in between there that we haven't completely got confirmed yet. But we're going to be sharing our primary message of discipleship and how people can understand how to become a disciple of Yeshua.
Okay. And if people listening right now wanted to attend one of these speaking engagements, I guess they would go into the website and get those specifics there?
You know, that's one thing I've intended to do, and I will do that in the next couple of days, hopefully before this podcast comes out. And I'll go ahead and put the itinerary up there so people can see that.
Okay, great, great. And I heard you have quite a road crew traveling with you, huh?
Oh, yeah. We are the seven peas in a pod. And we have five children and my wife that we're going to be making this trek together and enjoying this new little adventure in our lives.
Yeah, I saw you guys were going to be doing some camping along the way. It sounds like quite the adventure.
Oh, yeah. Fun times. Yeah. Fun times.
Hopefully you have more than 5 loaves and 2 fish, too. But
well, I don't know, you know.
Yeah. It's going to be kind of tight.
That's right.
Well, you guys will have a good time, I'm sure. And I, you know, I pray the Father blesses you and keeps you guys safe throughout these speaking engagements. How can people find out more about the ministry online? How do people support your ministry, more importantly? Okay.
Well, you know, a lot of the stuff that we have, we're making available on the website. It's, just as you said, emethatorah.com, emethatorah.com. And on that, you'll find a lot of our teachings. You'll find some audio resources. You'll be able to subscribe to our monthly newsletter. And this is a physical newsletter, a teaching newsletter that we send out every month. And and then with that, if you would like to, if you believe in what we're doing, we could definitely use your prayers. We could definitely use your financial support. Like I said, this ministry has been around for 10 years, but within the last few months, we have started over, literally. And so we have very, very, very little financial support. And we have large ambitions as far as what we're trying to do. We're in the middle of writing a book on discipleship. I'm about to wrap up a booklet on discipleship with sort of the core principles, the four responsibilities of a disciple. We've got a few other books and booklets in the work. We've got a complete a few audio series teachings. We're doing audio teaching every month for those who support us. And if you do support us, you become a financial contributor to this ministry, then we give you access to another part of the website where our what we call Talmudim supporters are able to access, and they get special messages that they can listen to each month, teachings on various subjects and topics. And so you can find out how to support us on the website, subscribe to the newsletter, see if you enjoy it, like it, and get something out of it. So, but we definitely need your prayers. We have a lot of work that we feel the Lord's calling us to do, and we need prayers to be able to do that.
Very cool, very cool. Well, Darren, thanks so much for joining me tonight and doing this despite our internet mishaps. And I look forward to having you on and getting an update on how your speaking engagements went and all that. So, again, thanks so much for being on tonight.
And I appreciate you having me. May the Lord bless you in everything that you do.
Thank you. And remember, those who are listening, your former state, you Gentiles by birth, called the uncircumcised, circumcised by those who merely because of an operation on their flesh are called the circumcised. At that time had no Messiah. You were estranged from the national life of Israel, and you were foreigners to the covenants, embodying God's promise. You were in this world without hope and without God. But now, you who were once far off have been brought near through the shedding of Messiah's blood. This has been the Grafted In Perspective. But you know what?
I appreciate it, buddy.
I didn't record any of that. We need to do over. I forgot to hit record. Okay.